On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf Michael Cannell, who is the author of Incendiary. We had the chance to talk about that book several years ago and what an amazing story it was. Now he brings another story, another true crime story to share with us. His brand new book is A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder, Inc. It's from Minotaur Books and is available online and in bookstores everywhere. It was, it's the tale of Abe Kid Twist Rellis. He is not as well known as the bigger names that we're going to discuss in this book, but he was a pivotal character in the growth of the mafia in America and a pivotal character in the downfall of some of its most brutal people, but he was not a nice guy either. So we're very excited. Michael, thank you so much for making time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Doug. It's really great to be back with you.
Thank you. Should we start out with talking about the beginning of organized crime? Or really, this guy is kind of around for the beginning of it being an organized sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of broad background to this is that during Prohibition, the neighborhood thug, you know, became a network. They began to bootleg liquor, they controlled speakeasies, they controlled prostitution. They were making piles of money without even trying very hard. So Prohibition was kind of the golden age of money making for the mob. But when Prohibition ended, and a new generation of mobsters took over, they changed some things. They really wanted to run the mob like an efficient American corporation. It was not as easy to make money, so they changed the way they worked. They wanted to set up a coast-to-coast, nationwide network of mobs and run it sort of like McDonald's with franchises in every city. And part of their plan was to have an assassination squad. The idea was that if this assassination squad could kill off all the informants, anybody who could possibly testify against them in court, then they would never be prosecuted. And it worked for about a decade. And the man who was kind of the field general of that was Abe Kid Twist Rellis. He was a Jewish mobster who come up through the ranks in Brooklyn, and he was responsible for fielding these phone calls from mobs all across the country, and then arranging for people to be assassinated from Miami to Los Angeles. And nobody knows exactly how many were killed, but it was certainly in the hundreds.
People that were over him, the people that were the, if you will, maybe not the godfathers, but kind of the lieutenants to the godfathers, these guys found out that he was the kind of guy that would take care of anybody. So if they had any kind of problem with him whatsoever, for any reason whatsoever, all they had to do was put the head out on him, and Kid Twist would get it done.
Yeah, Kid Twist was a kid who grew up in Brownsville, Brooklyn, which was then considered to be the toughest neighborhood in America, maybe the toughest neighborhood of all time, as far as I know. And he, you know, he punched his way up the ranks. He had a little gang of other Jewish gangsters or gangster wannabes, and they wanted to overthrow the top dogs, the three Shapiro brothers. And Kid Twist didn't think that he had the muscle to do it. So he formed an alliance with some Italian gangsters from a neighboring, an adjacent neighborhood. And together they overthrew the Shapiro brothers. Very interesting because, you know, until then, the gangs broke down along these ethnic lines. So for the first time, you see Italian and Jewish gangsters working together. And this story of Kid Twist fighting his way to supremacy in Brooklyn did not go unnoticed by the very top mobsters in New York, the so-called mob lords. When they needed an assassin in chief, they hired him.
The people who wanted to hang around with the made guys hung around with guys like Abe. So if he needed somebody to go steal a car for a job, or to get rid of a car, or to get rid of a car with a corpse in the trunk, then there was always somebody who was willing to do it for a price. So he built up an organization that came to be called Murder, Inc., that they were the, shall we say, they were the disposal arm of the mafia.
Yeah, exactly right. They didn't call themselves Murder, Inc. Kid Twist called his operation The Combination because of this mix of Jewish and Italian gangsters, but a newspaper reporter called the Murder, Inc., and the name stuck. But it's exactly as you described it. They were very, very organized and very efficient and very ruthless. Every man had his job. Some specialized in stealing cars, as you said. Some specialized in disposing of stolen cars. Some men were responsible for driving, and some men were just responsible for killing. And if a call came in from Detroit or St. Louis, the killers would pack a suitcase like any middle management figure would, and with a clean change of clothes, only in their case, the suitcase would also include a gun, a rope, an ice pick, and they would fly off and do their job, and they would get back on the next plane afterwards. They would usually be back in Brooklyn before the police in Detroit were trying to gather suspects. He was the guy who went and collected money from loans, shook down grocery stores for protection money. He did legwork, and he roughed people up for them. But they kind of took him for granted and disrespected him. And so he went to one of the big bosses, Albert Anastasia, who was kind of the mob lord of Brooklyn, and asked permission to bump off the Shapiro brothers. And Anastasia gave his permission on the understanding, which is always the case in these kinds of deals, on the understanding that Anastasia would get a percentage of everything that Kid Twist made from then on.
So there's always somebody, even though they're shaking down people, running protection rackets and so forth in the local neighborhoods and stealing from their community, there was always somebody else that was getting a cut of that too.
Yeah, I mean, in that way, really, it was very organized and almost like a kind of corporate structure. The money would go up the rank, particularly with a figure like Albert Anastasia. Every time stolen goods were loaded on a truck, he got a portion of it. Every time a prostitute took a customer upstairs, he got a portion of it. Every time a case of liquor was bootlegged, he got a portion of it. It was very intricately worked out and very profitable.
It's like Ebel Amway or something. Some of these guys that you write about here are people that those of us who have seen the movies or have read other books about organized crime in big cities in America back in the 30s and 40s and 50s have heard of these guys, Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, and so forth. These are guys that will reach out to Abe Reles eventually and say, we've heard good words about you. We know you get the job done and that you take care of things and you keep your mouth shut. We've got a job for you.
Exactly. I mean, what would happen is that really Lucky Luciano was the mastermind of what was known as the Commission, this nationwide confederacy of mobs. And Lucky Luciano or Lepke Buchholter or Albert Anastasia, one of the big bosses, would get a call from Chicago or from Miami, and it would be the head of the local mob, and that man would say, we have somebody here in our ranks who we think is talking to the FBI, and we need to get rid of him. Better for the mob in Chicago not to be involved, that was part of the thinking, then let's say they would call Albert Anastasia. Albert Anastasia, in turn, would call a payphone in the back of an all-night candy store in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And that was Kid Twist's headquarters. He and his guys would sit in a booth in the back of this candy store. When the phone rang, it would be instructions to fly to Chicago or fly to Miami. And when they arrived in that city, they would be met by associates of the local mob who would take them to do what they needed to do, and then they would get out. It worked for everybody, except, of course, the victim.
One of the names that I had not heard before that I learned about from your book was the highest-ranking Jewish mobster in New York, a fellow named Louis Lepke Burkhalter.
Lepke Burkhalter operated at the same level, but not that many people have heard of him, and that's the way he wanted it. You know, most of these gangsters really lived large. They had, you know, women stashed all over the place. They rolled into nightclubs, you know, with danced on tables with chorus girls. Lepke Burkhalter was the opposite. He lived with his wife and stepson very quietly on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He barely drank anything. He liked to play Scrabble after dinner, and that was kind of the extent of his social life. So he was very deliberately not flamboyant, and that served him well until things went bad for him, as they did for many of these other men.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Michael Cannell, who is the author of A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder, Inc. It's from Minotaur Books and available online and in bookstores everywhere. You've got amazing photographs in here. Some of them are pretty awful because we're reading about the mob. And some of them are very interesting because it also talks about, since we've just had an election cycle, it talks about a guy who is probably best known as a guy who lost an extremely close race in 1948 for the presidency with the incumbent, Harry Truman. The iconic picture of Truman holding up the newspaper with the headline, Dewey Beats Truman, and laughing because it's turned out he didn't beat Truman. Dewey is a guy who is a young gangbuster, the baby prosecutor who sets out to bust a vast and intricately organized nationwide crime syndicate. And he's really one of the big stars of this book. This is a guy who is as determined as the mobsters are to stop them.
Yeah, I mean, he is really, really a fascinating figure. As you said, he is now a punchline because of that photograph that you described. He ran for president and lost to Truman, famously. But he started out as what the newspapers called a baby prosecutor. He was only in his 30s when he was named special prosecutor to address the almost total control that the mob had over New York City, and largely because of Murder, Inc., nobody thought he was going to get anywhere. It seemed like an impossible assignment. An impossible assignment because the mob had made so much money, they paid off practically everybody. And impossible because in order to try these figures in court, Dewey would need witnesses. He would need people who would be willing to testify in court. Nobody was willing to do that because they knew that Murder, Inc. was waiting to do horrible things to them and their family if they testified. And so how on earth could Dewey do this? Well, Dewey's solution was to start by rounding up prostitutes. He raided the brothels, and the women that he rounded up were, in many cases, drug addicts. And he gave them the choice of either going to jail for a long time or testifying against the mob figures who controlled the brothels, controlled the whorehouses. Many of them chose to go to jail rather than face the consequences. But some of them were willing, some of them just bet that Thomas Dewey was going to bust Murder, Inc. and bust the mob and that they would be safe. And so that was the beginning, that was the very beginning of the end for Murder, Inc. And the related mobsters.
Now, this gets started in really kind of in the early 1930s with Dewey. This is as Prohibition has ended at this point. The mob has taken this vast amounts of money that they've made and funneled it into other nasty things that they could make money on, selling drugs, selling people, and shake. They still shake people down. And Dewey is given a fair amount of authority. And I love this in here where you're talking about. I'm going to quote you. Let me find the same qualities that would later make Dewey a clumsy candidate, a prim risk, rectitude and bloodless efficiency made him a lethal prosecutor. And it starts at 1933, the fall of 33, where he starts pinning these guys down and starts setting them up with a seamless kind of prosecution with so many witnesses that pretty soon the mob realizes that this guy is not just some Boy Scout that they can blow off. This guy is serious, and he's not going to be stopped.
He's not going to be stopped, and it's kind of funny. I mean, Thomas Dewey was like a robot of ruthlessness and efficiency. The one part of him that I think you could say was artistic or soft in any way was that he was a trained vocalist. He was a singer, and so I think he took from that his background in choral singing and opera singing a sense of performance, because he would really take over these courtrooms just with his presence and his sense of delivery, and his baritone voice would just mesmerize the jury. And Lucky Luciano, who by all accounts was one of the most just vicious, cold-blooded figures, later described how absolutely terrified he was of Dewey when Dewey rose from his seat in the courtroom.
I think this would make such a compelling new movie to have somebody, to let it be a movie about Thomas Dewey and what he does to bring these guys down. And they start harassing his family. They call his pregnant wife and tell him that she needs to come down to the morgue to identify her husband's body and stuff like this. And he's not dead. They're just harassing him. But then there's also an internal problem that the commission is having over a guy who's kind of a loudmouth, and they consider him to be more dangerous to them at this point than Dewey even. And this is when they are thinking about getting rid of Dutch Schultz, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really obsessed with this part of the story. I mean, I'm obsessed with all of it, but this is particularly strange, fascinating digression that you've mentioned. Dutch Schultz was just a psychopath, and he knew that he was number one on Dewey's list, and so he went to the big bosses in the so-called commission and said, "We need to assassinate Dewey because he's going to send us all to the electric chair." Well, they didn't want to assassinate Dewey because, if they knew that if they assassinated Dewey, the heat was going to come down on all of them. So
right.
Dutch Schultz said, "Fine, I'll kill him myself." And so at that point, they decided, we're not going to kill Dewey. We're going to kill Dutch Schultz. We can't have him killing Dewey. And so Dutch Schultz was shot in a chop house in Newark late at night. He didn't die right away. He went to the hospital. And in the hospital, the police were interrogating him while he had a 106-degree fever. And the transcript reads almost like like a bizarre, surreal poem. He's delirious. And later, the beat poet William Burroughs took that transcript and turned it into a screenplay called called The Last Words of Dutch Schultz. Never made into a movie, but it was produced on stage.
Yeah, it's just a bizarre situation. But, you know, looking at it from the position of the mobsters, that makes perfect sense, because this was an uncontrollable guy. This was not a guy that would play by their rules, and he threatened them. Like you said, if Dewey dies, then all the heat comes down, and they felt like they could handle Dewey if they didn't have to worry about wild cards like Dutch Schultz. So he has to go. This is not.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we think of these characters as being like Wild West figures shooting places up, but they really weren't like that. They were really risk averse. They only killed to avoid risk. They only killed in order to make things safer for themselves. And so they deliberated very carefully over this question and just decided that it presented less risk to kill Dutch Schultz.
Lucky Luciano is a significant crime figure like Al Capone was. But the others learn from Capone, because Al Capone, who's not really a figure of real significance in this story, Capone was bigger than life. He liked to be seen as some kind of Robin Hood kind of character or something. And he liked flashing it around. He liked everybody to know who he was. Lucky Luciano didn't like anybody knowing who he was. And he tried to stay out of the limelight as much as possible, not just to avoid prosecution, but also he just didn't want people to in his business. And I find that very interesting, that even though they're both Italian mobsters, they're very different in temperament.
I mean, Lucky Luciano loved women. He loved the high life. But just as you say, he did not relish being a public figure. He didn't want anybody to photograph him. He lived under an assumed name in the Waldorf Astoria. He owned his own airplane, which for the 1930s must have been pretty, you know, really unusual.
Yeah.
And so he would slip out of town when there was any heat, any risk of any kind. He would get on his Lockheed and fly to Miami or to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was then a mob getaway, a place where they could gamble and kind of hide in luxury. So no, he was a very Lucky Luciano was a very steely figure and really frightening to most people around him.
Dewey eventually thinks he has Luciano in a situation where he can be convicted. So he gets an arrest warrant. They have to chase him down, like you said, from Hot Springs and everything. They get him into court, and Luciano thinks that he's going to be able to talk his way out of this problem. It does not go like he expects.
I mean, Lucky Luciano, like most of these figures, was used to getting into trouble and then getting out of trouble. Remember that from Prohibition on, the mob had made so much money that it was pretty much a universal practice of theirs to pay off not just patrolmen on the beat, but police officials, judges, district attorneys, and city officials. Lucky Luciano was used to getting out of these situations by paying the right people. Not the case with Thomas Dewey, who was sort of like Elliot Ness. He was, you know, lily white and beyond reproach, beyond corruption. So when he met Dewey, he met his match. The end of that, ironically, the end of that confrontation is that Luciano went to jail in a very bleak upstate New York jail, and it was Thomas Dewey some years later, then governor of New York, who released Luciano, who pardoned him, because Luciano had used his connections with the mob and the waterfront, the New York City docks, to help the war effort during World War II. So, ironically, Luciano put him away, and then some years later was the one who released him.
That's a very interesting part of the story as well. And our time is almost up. I haven't been watching the clock, and wow, we're almost out of time, and we haven't even killed off Abe yet. Should we take a couple of minutes and try to wrap this story up? Luciano goes to prison. More and more of these guys. Dewey gets 52 straight convictions, and that's not even to the middle of the book yet. And then he starts going after even more guys. And at some point, Abe Relist, Kid Twist, decides that he's going to do the one thing that he's murdered untold numbers of people for doing, and that is rat out his bosses.
Yeah, Kid Twist has spent his adult life killing informants, and then he becomes the biggest informant of all. And then the question is, can the police and the prosecutors keep him alive long enough to testify? And the answer is no. He goes out the window of a hotel in Coney Island where he's being kept under layers of police protection. And he goes out the window of his bedroom early one morning, just before he is to testify against Lepke Buchalter. And he's found dead on the gravel roof of the kitchen annex next to the hotel. The police called it an escape attempt. Nobody believes that it was an escape attempt. Somebody killed him. The question is, was it the mob? Did the mob pay off the police? Did the police do it themselves? Because, of course, Kid Twist knew all about the corruption in the police department. Is it possible that, in fact, District Attorney of Brooklyn, William O'Dwyer, knew something about this, was involved? Years later, when William O'Dwyer was beginning to be asked about that, he was then mayor of New York. He abruptly resigned and became the ambassador to Mexico. Probably not a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm thinking not. There certainly are plenty of villains in this story, and a few heroes. And Thomas Dewey is one of the heroes. And then there are those like Abe Relist who looked out for themselves, and when they thought that there was no other way to avoid the inevitable, decided to turn on their employers. But considering their employers were people that had other people viciously murdered or viciously assaulted or sold into sex slavery and things like that, it's hard to feel a whole lot of rancor or sympathy for the people that he ratted out. That's for sure.
Right. I mean, it's a time when everybody had an agenda, and including the prosecutors, because the prosecutors saw this as their opportunity to have political careers, and it worked for O'Dwyer, and it worked for Dewey, not unlike Rudy Giuliani. They used busting the mob as a way to get ahead.
It is absolutely a fascinating story, Michael, and I'm so tickled that you were able to come back to On the Bookshelf and talk to us again. Can people go to your website to find out more about this book and your other books?
Yeah, the website is Michael Cannell, that's C-A-N-N-E-L-L, michaelcannell.com, and anybody should feel free to email me. My email is there, or to tweet me. My Twitter is Michael Cannell.
Easy to get a hold of you. Michael, thank you so much, and I look forward to your next book. There's no telling what fascinating stories that you will come up with, but I sure enjoyed reading A Brotherhood Betrayed. Thanks so much for being with us today.
This was great. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Our thanks once again to Michael Cannell, the author of A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder, Inc., from Minotaur Books. Check out his website, Michael Cannell, that's CANNELL.com. Next week, we'll take a real look at the Puritans. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.